Hey, podcasters, welcome to another edition of Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. I'm your host, Mesterdahl. On today's show, we're talking about the NTA show. It's also called the Work Truck Show. It's happening right now in Indianapolis. I decided to skip it, although I've thought about going. there's lots of cool information there. It's more of a commercial truck show. It's not a segment I deal with very often, so it's not something I know a lot about, but it's fun to see these big commercial trucks, class 1 through class 5, and different adaptations of vans and SUV, or mostly vans, not SUVs, excuse me, that are outfitted for plumbers and construction workers and caterers and things. Making news at the show was the truck guys, right? Ram, Chevy, and Ford all had some pretty interesting news there at the show. Let's start off with Ram. Ram actually unveiled this. I saw it in person in Chicago. It is an upfitter tool. It's a virtual reality upfitter tool. So what you do is you take like an iPad and you take a photo of a ProMaster van, and then you can play with the different configurations of what an upfitter would do. You can change and put like a different boxes on the end. You can do different interior setups and things at the rear end of it. You can really just play around the sizes of it. It's kind of a fun thing. They call it the Augmented Reality Upfit Configurator. It's a fun little thing to play around. It's a sales tool, really. It's instead of playing with that round out online, you can take a photo of it and really like walk through virtual reality of it and really see it up close in person. Again, another handy kind of tool. They expanded that. It was only on the full-size ProMaster van. It now includes the ProMaster City and the Ram chassis cab. So you can look at a chassis cab with 3,500, 4,500, and 5,500. And you can decide whether you want like a flat bed, if you want the flat bed with the wood rails, if you want a headache rack on it, if you want to do like a bunch of boxes around the sides like you would see like a utility worker would have. And so you can play around different configurations. Another thing they made news was they have a new Q Pro program. This is a qualification process for different upfitters. What they're trying to do is they're trying to get these upfitters to send in their products to Ram, and Ram can officially recognize and validate it, and then they can receive feedback. The upfitter can receive feedback from Ram engineers on product improvement certification. What Ram's trying to do here is trying to say, you know, this product is approved by Ram. We've tested it. We know it works. It's a good upfitter product. They're trying to get away from maybe some of the stuff that doesn't work, and that consumers sometimes will they will target the Ram truck as having the problem when actually it was an upfitter's. When it was an upfitter's accessory, that actually was a product problem. And so they're trying to get beyond that, build more quality in the upfitter program, and give the consumers more of an option for finding Ram-approved upfitter accessories and products. Another thing making the news at the show, and we're going to have next week, I'm hoping to have it on the program, is Chevrolet introduced a 6500 XD low-cab Ford truck. Okay, so they introduced a box truck, is what it really is. It's a smaller box truck. It's more like, think of a U-Haul, but with the commercial front end. It's a flat front end. And what they're trying to do is Chevy's just adding to the commercial vehicle lineup. This truck has maximum gross vehicle weighting of 2,950 pounds, 12,000 pounds of front axle and rear axle of 19,000 pounds. It's going to have the dock height chassis on the back, so you can pull up to a dock and unload. It's going to have the Allison transmission and the Duramax diesel engine. And what's interesting to me on this whole new truck is that Chevrolet had kind of gotten away from the commercial side a little bit. And now they're coming back, and they've made some changes to their lineup, and they're really adding to what they're offering. And so it seems like they're going to try to be more competitive in the commercial side, which is interesting because they just pulled out of Europe and they sold Opel, and that they haven't focused so much in the fleet side in their consumer trucks. Their half ton, three quarter ton, and one tons. I've talked to many reps who said that they're trying to pull that back a little bit and do more consumer sales there. And so maybe they're trying to do more commercial sales in the bigger trucks. Just an interesting strategy. I'm hoping to get somebody on the podcast next week to talk a little bit more about that and to maybe get an idea what they're kind of up to. You know, it's a little bit different of an approach. GM is changing and they're seeing market needs changing, and so they're changing up their focus. I think it's going to impact consumers' vehicles as well, because the team is only so big, and yeah, you have a lot of resources going around. They're a big company, but when they contracted because they sold Opel and contracted a little bit, you know, they're going to have some focus areas in different areas, and they're not going to be they're not going to be as big as they used to be. So it's going to be interesting to see how they develop all this stuff and how it comes to marketplace. I'm also curious in the Cummins diesel, or not the Cummins, but the Duramax diesel. I just drove the consumer version last month, and I'm going to see what the difference is here. I know this, the Duramax in the commercial grade is a 5.2 liter four-cylinder turbo diesel. It's 520 foot-pounds of torque, and it's got the Allison 2500 series six-speed automatic transmission, excuse me, and a Dana rear axle. So it's got a pretty good powertrain. I'm just going to be curious to see if they've made any changes there, if they're thinking about making any changes based on what the consumer Duramax had. So we'll have more information for you on that. Again, I think it's interesting how they're growing that segment of their business, a segment they just hadn't grown a whole lot. Finally, with news, was Ford. Ford has made news in a small way. Ford has done a lot of these smaller news items and turned them into, like, that's what they're focusing on. It's company-wide, they have a really different take on the auto industry right now. And their news was that they have expanded their advanced fuel qualified vehicle modifier program. All right, so they've advanced their supplier base for vehicle modifiers and advanced fuel, so like alternative fuel train, powertrains and things. Specifically, hybrids, Lightning hybrids and XL hybrids and Motive power systems were all named an official EQVM. The QVM it stands for quality vehicle, qualified vehicle modifier. The EQVM is their hybrid version of that. What they're trying to do with these modifiers is they're trying to get them to say a couple things. First of all, that anything upfitted by one of these EQVM modifiers is going to have the Ford warranty still intact. And secondly, these modifiers have to meet Ford's standards for quality and reliability. So, like, it's the same idea the Q program that Ram had. These modifiers have to meet certain standards and get certified by Ford. What's interesting about some of these modifiers, they're doing different things, and they're doing more hybrids. They're trying to, what we're going to get to eventually is the manufactured hybrid F-150 from Ford coming through the factory line. Currently, it's an adaptation process through a upfitter. And what that company is doing is it's XL Hybrids. They are offering battery electric hybrid upfits for the Ford Transit, E350, E450 chassis, Ford Super Duty pickups, Ford F650, 750, and F53 and 59 strip chassis vans. Wow, tongue-tied this morning. If you can see all the terminology there, Ford likes the F-series of vehicles. What's interesting with the XL Hybrid's method of hibernation is that they have an electric motivator, they call it. It's on the drive shaft and rather than working through the transmission. So they're speeding that drive shaft up, which is just an interesting way to do it. Usually it comes from the engine. It sits in the engine and goes down through the transmission and changes how those gearings work and how that spins that drive shaft. So they're skipping the transmission. What they say is this has a little bit, small amount of efficiency lost when you skip the transmission, but it's a lot easier to upfit the vehicle because you leave the powertrain intact and you just add a little bit of electric modifier, which is probably a battery with a motor on it, and you attach that to drive shaft, probably at the end of the transmission, and it helps speed that drive shaft up a little faster, which means that the engine doesn't have to work as hard, which is where you're having your hybrid system. So a very interesting way to do hybrid. I haven't heard of anybody else doing that. Easy upfit. I mean, it seems like it's a bolt-on product. I'm going to try to get more for you on that as well down the road as I learn more about it. Finally, the story-making news, not at the NTEA work show. It's kind of political. And you got to talk about it because it's going to be a big impact for consumers. The current administration, the Trump administration, is taking a look back at the EPA rules that were imposed at the end of Obama's administration. So if you remember, the end of Obama's administration was a little messy. There was a lot of things happening that were not well received by the industry. And one of those things wasn't well received was that the EPA was the automakers asked the EPA to review the CAFE requirements, the corporate average fuel economy requirements. And essentially, the EPA said no. They were keeping them the same. Obama did promise a review, and it looks like that the EPA didn't follow through on his words. And so what they want to do is that the automakers want those review those rules reviewed, and they want them altered and lessened so they're not so stringent. The reason why this makes a big impact for everybody is that those CAFE rules have a lot of dictating on trucks, because trucks are based on, it's based on footprint, and trucks have a big footprint. And so if you think about the most fuel inefficient vehicles on the road, those are typically trucks. And so what the rules have been doing have been pushing trucks to get more, better and better fuel economy and as a whole. So the companies are based on corporate average fuel economies based on their entire fleet. And so that's like for like a GM or a Ford or something like that, that's cars through trucks through sedan. I mean, it's everything, the entire breadth of what they're offering. And so when they initially set those standards years ago, the idea was is that electric vehicles were going to take off. And so you're going to be able to take those electric vehicles and each one would get a credit, and you could take that credit and apply it to a truck. And as electric vehicles take off the marketplace, the corporate average fuel economy for a company would increase. So if, you know, if you were selling no electric vehicles and you sold 20 trucks back, I think it was 2007, 2008 when this was first talked about, when you look at that, you're not being very fuel efficient across your corporate average fuel economy lineup, right? You're selling a bunch of trucks. And so what the EPA thought was going to happen was that electric vehicles were going to take off. People weren't going to buy as many SUVs like Tahoes and Yukons, and truck sales were not going to be as strong. And so they theorized that for every truck sold, they would sell electric vehicle, or electric vehicle and small car sedan sales would grow to the fact that they would mitigate the truck and SUV sales. It was going to offset that. And at that time, it made a lot of sense, because if you remember back 2007, 2008, 2009, fuel pricing was really high. You know, California, I think some places in California, it was like $5 a gallon. I mean, it was maybe even $8. I mean, it was really, the price per gallon was really high. People were buying lots of cars. GM went bankrupt because they put a lot of money into their Tahoe and Yukons and trucks and not a lot of money into cars. You know, so there, that, those are the factors involved in what happened back then, plus the economy crashed. So what they thought was going to happen was electric vehicles were going to take off to such a degree that it was going to offset all these truck sales. 10 years later, that just hasn't happened. Electric vehicles still occupy a single-digit margin of the, or not margin, single-digit market share of the entire market. That they just don't. They're just not a big seller. Certain areas of the country they're bigger. California, East Coast. You know, more electric vehicles are being sold, but in the heart of the country, the heartland is still buying a lot of big SUVs and a lot of trucks, and they're okay with the fuel economy, which is against what the EPA thought was going to happen. Their projections were that electric cars were going to sell, small sedans were going to sell. Flip forward to today, and heck, you got companies like Fiat Chrysler of America. They don't even sell a car. They killed the Dart 200. They killed the Dart Chrysler 200. They're only selling their sedans and trucks. They sell an electric Fiat in California that they have talked about consistently of losing money at. You look at GM and the Volt and the Bolt, they're both doing pretty well, but the numbers still aren't as high as their truck sales. They're not equaling those numbers. And so what you're finding is you're finding consumers just aren't following along with the EPA thought they were going to follow along with. And so there needs to be some review of the rules based on the current market and the current buying public and what they're looking for. I think you'll find that the truck targets are probably going to drop somewhat, because you're going to have to take in the fact that consumers just aren't buying electric cars. They're just not doing it. And hybrids are not taking off as much as they thought they were going to. And so I think there's going to be, I think the review is smart. I don't think it's a Trump or Obama thing. People can make it all political. I think it just makes sense. You know, you implement some rules, you go with it for several years, you see how things shake out, and then you review them. It's like any business, like my business. I go a couple years, see how things work out, and then I change. I alter. I go 6 months and I say, how's that work? And then I make change. We all do this in life. And so I think that's a natural thing for the EPA to do. And I'm excited to see how those turn out and what's going to happen down the road. But it's a big impact for consumers because trucks have been pushing so hard to become so fuel efficient that you had a lot of new features like aluminum body on the Fords, auto start stop coming into trucks. You had small displacement turbo diesel engines like the 2.7 liter. You had a lot of conversation about hybrids and things. And like Ford has a hybrid truck they're working on. If you change those standards up and you don't mandate that they hit those marks, you know, I don't know that they still do it. There's a argument going on right now about who really drives innovation. Is it consumers and consumer demand driving innovation? Is it government regulations demanding new innovation? Or is it companies on their own doing their own innovation? I happen to believe it's consumers and it's government that push innovation. And if you have government pulling back on the innovation with setting rules that are more easily targetable targets, and you have look at consumer behavior, which is not really asking for a hybrid truck, that's not really asking for an electric truck, that's okay with what's in the marketplace because that's what they're buying, I don't believe that companies will do their own innovation to create those products if there's no demand. And so you have to wonder what's going to happen with all these, with Ford and the way they're moving forward. Specifically Ford, I'm not picking on them, it just happens to be that's what they're doing these days. Will they keep the innovation going, or will they dial it back and go back to what they were doing, which is just building big steel trucks? I think they're going to stay aluminum. I just don't know about the 2.7 liter, and I don't know about electric, and I don't know about hybrids. I don't know if that will continue to be something they offer, because I don't know that the share of those vehicles they sell, that, you know, like how many 2.7 liter EcoBoost engine they sell versus 3.5. I don't know if that share of engines is going to be high enough to lead them to keep putting R&D and marketing behind those products. I think that I don't know that they sell enough to make that make sense, and from a business take standpoint. So I think it's very, very interesting what's happening in the marketplace right now. Something to keep an eye on, and I can't wait to see what happens to the EPA. It's going to be a long process. We probably won't hear anything until summer or fall because these review processes just take months to work, and it's the federal government. It's going to take a long time to get done. So up next on the show, and we'll move on from the news, we have a really good interview with Chad Kirshner. He's with Future Motoring. He's been on the show before, and he and I can talk for hours about trucks. So I try to cut him off. It's going to be half an hour. And then I'm gonna do a little bit of a review of a Toyota Tacoma off-road I've been driving this week. So stay tuned for more. And welcome back to Pickup Truck Plus, SUV Talk. I'm your host, Mr. Stroll. Next on the program, we have special guest Chad Kirshner. He actually has his own podcast called Future Motoring. You should probably check it out. He was making me very jealous this last week.
This I do very generally.
Guy slash friend went to the Mint 400 with Toyota and got to experience the off-road event. So welcome to the show, guy friend.
Well, thanks, Tim, for having me on. I appreciate you allowing me to return the favor because you've been on my show a couple of times talking truck stuff. So we had this, like, the Mint 400, for those who aren't familiar at all, it's one of the – I don't have the stats in front of me, but it's one of the older desert off-road races. It was initially sponsored by the Mint Hotel in Las Vegas, which is how it got its name, the Mint. Over the course of years, the format has changed some. It also hasn't run continuously either. There have been years where it hasn't happened. But basically, the current sort of version, it's broken up into classes, but the main trophy truck class runs, I want to say, either three or four laps. And each lap, like, you're thinking, oh, four laps, that can't be that big of a deal. But each lap is 113 miles long through the desert. So you basically get a bunch of guys, you know, guys and girls together with off-road vehicles and razors and trucks and all that stuff, and you go race through the desert. You start at Prim, Nevada, which is basically state line, and the course takes you pretty much to Vegas and then back around, and it goes through the mountains and through the desert and all sorts of different types of terrain. And what's interesting and challenging for it is none of the competitors that we talked to, like all of them had mentioned, like you are racing against each other, like it is a timed kind of event, but you're really racing against the desert. So a victory for a lot of these guys is just finishing, you know, because you're out in the middle of nowhere. You're facing some of the grueliest, you know, the most grueling, dangerous terrain in this country. And things can change from lap to lap, too. So because there were some 330-some competitors this year, mm-hmm. they do a staggered start, so people are all over the course at any different time. What might happen one lap, how the course might be in one particular spot in one lap, might be completely different the next. There might be a giant boulder where none was before. And that can create an interesting challenge, especially as the sun starts to set. This goes into the night for the competitors. So it's a very interesting form of racing, a form of motorsports. You know, imagine rallying kind of on steroids. If you've never really, if you've never really followed desert racing at all, it's part of the Best in the Desert series, which also includes the Baja 1000, which is probably the more familiar, recognized off-road race. But the Mint's the biggest in the United States, and it's a heck of a lot of fun. I mean, obviously I don't want to take all your time just, you know, spewing stuff. I'll let you ask questions, but there's some cool things about it. So there's a
bucket list that just so the audience talk. I'm just letting him talk. He's just, this is good. You wind him up like a toy, and then you just let him go. He's just like those little ducky things you wind up, he just goes.
Oh, hey, I should show you. Never mind. I'll post it on my Instagram. But it's a really cool form of motorsports because it is sort of a top-tier event. The Mint 400 isn't, you know, it's not necessarily amateur hour. But they do have classes from basically these weekend warriors all the way up to these professional trophy truck drivers. So anybody with you know, a few bucks in a vehicle can enter in an event like this and race, you know, against some of the best in the sport. But it's broken up into kind of multiple categories. So you've got like this entry-level prosumer sort of group. There's like these Razor sort of off-road kind of, you know, like Polaris Razor type vehicles. And then you have in trophy trucks, you have a trophy truck, you have a limited class, and then you have an unlimited. So the limited, you're restricted to, you all have to run the same engine and transmission package, I believe. And then unlimited is, throw as much money as you want into it and go at it. So we were there with Toyota, so it was important that we meet the Toyota factory back driver, which is BJ Baldwin. He drives for Toyota, and now Monster Energy is his main sponsor. He's got something like $500,000 wrapped up into his one truck, and he's got, you know, a few of those. So it can be expensive. But talking to some guys just, you know, wandering around, like you can get into it for fairly cheap. Like the big, you know, trophy truck unlimited engines, you know, they have to be rebuilt after every race, and it's like $75,000 for the engine and all of that. But I mean, there was a guy that we talked to that he got into it for like $20,000, you know, all like sort of all in. So if you have a desire for the sport, it's not too terribly expensive to kind of get into. Now, obviously, you're likely going to break stuff, and you're going to have to, you know, be set up for that. But
and that was one of the challenges, because like you said, it was 130 miles per lap, and so you really didn't have, you don't really have pit stops.
Right. So
if you broke something, you could try to nurse it home, really.
Right. Well, there is a pit area at the start finish line, but the rest of the time you're kind of on your own. So some of the funny stories and interesting stories that we've heard through the weekend, I mean, obviously, is one, if something breaks, you have to fix it. Our mutual friend at Toyota, Mr. Mike Swears, who's also he's the chief engineer of Tacoma and Tundra. Mm-hmm. I talked to him a little bit, and he was riding along with some of the Dirt Everyday guys to do a segment. And I was like, so, hey, are you excited to be riding along with journalists? He's like, oh, I'm just fix something if it breaks. I'm like, well, you're in a Toyota pickup truck and you're the chief engineer. I think that's a good,
melding. I think you can find all the bolt points for that part. I think you can figure that out.
Right. But No, and when I talked about, you know, racing the desert first, there is a whole lot of co-opetition going on, you know. If you come up on some guy stranded, you're going to stop. And I mean, these competitors are going to stop. They're going to make sure they're okay. They're going to – there might be a situation like, oh, hey, you know, I cooked my brake fluid. I need some – you know, I need more brake fluid. Oh, I've got some. Like, there's all – everybody's willing to kind of help each other out. And then even the spectators. So in the spectator zones, a lot of times – you know, there'll be a truck limping around, and there'll be one just happened, was yelling out to all of us if we had brake fluid when we were in that sort of area, which of course I didn't have any to give him. But sure enough, some guy came running up from one of the cars that was in the spectator area. He's like, "Oh, here, have this." So, you know, you really are trying to beat the desert and the challenge of the desert first and foremost.
Speaking of spectators now, this isn't an easy sport for spectators to watch because 130 miles on and back, but you had a unique viewpoint.
Okay, so if you're a quote-unquote normal person to go to a race,
right,
you can spectate from the start-finish line, or you can spectate from a couple of spectator zones that they have set up. Those you have to camp out like early in the morning to get to. One of the people that we were there with said that like they were there at like 6 or 7 in the morning for a noon start race to make sure they got the spot they wanted and all of that. So, it's a lot like a rally, and you kind of got to pick a corner or pick a spot, and that's kind of where you watch the action. Because it's a staggered start and trucks and razors and stuff are all at different speeds, you get to see a lot of stuff going on. But there are still many parts of the course where you have no idea what's going on, which is where our good friends at Toyota helped me out. We went up in a helicopter. So they had the Mints had helicopters there that were doing filming, presumably for either a web series or a DVD or something, you know, they sell afterwards. But we also were able to go up into a helicopter, and this wasn't like a go up, hover, sightseeing sort of deal. This was our pilot had been covering racing for, I think he said, 10 or 12 years. We were doing things in a helicopter that you wouldn't really expect from a, you know, kind of a spectator perspective. So a lot of times, if we were clear of like power lines and other helicopters, you know, we were 50, 100 feet off the ground doing, you know, 100, 120 miles an hour, trying to keep up with these trophy trucks to get photos and stuff, which is really cool because, you know, you were literally hovering right next to them or right on top of them at a perspective that really nobody can get. And, you know, watching the racing, which is, it's surreal. It's incredible. It was already a fun experience, but what really sealed the deal as being, you know, a really memorable trip was to be able to go up in the helicopter and view it that way.
Okay. So I want our listeners to understand that it is at this point I saw the photos and I got really freaking jealous, right? So this is the crucial moment. Oh, he's going to the race. It's fine. Yeah, that's fine. You go to the race. I know you can't see a lot. And then he posts photos of him being in a helicopter following the guys around. Now, that is the point where we cross the jealousism barrier. And I went to that next level with my friend that next time I see him, I will express my gratitude to his photos and beat him down a little bit for all the jealousy I have. But it really was a cool way to see the race because a lot of times these races are really impossible to follow, which is why they haven't really taken off so much in the U.S. because they're hard to follow. So, you know, versus, say, a NASCAR, you can get a seat and you can – it's contained. It's a race you can watch. And even IndyCars run into this issues before where the race gets so far out of the zones of people to be able to watch, it's hard to keep up.
Right. I mean, like, you talk about Indy cars in general. I mean, the Indy 500 in Indianapolis Motor Speedway is a hard track to spectate because the main grandstands block both sides of the track, so you can't see what's going on sort of beyond that. Now imagine that to, like, the extreme, where you get if you're even in one of these spectator zones, you might be able to see the equivalent of half a mile each way of, you know, trucks going by, and that's sort of it. And then out in the distance, like, way out in the distance, you can see the dust trails and stuff from the trucks. So you can kind of see where the trucks are and how soon they're going to get to you. But all you get is this, you know, brief sort of flyby of a trophy truck and then usually a helicopter following it from that normal spectator's perspective. But to be able to go up in, like I said, to go up into a helicopter, again, you got to dodge. There's a lot of power lines out in the middle of the desert. Imagine that. that you got to look out for. You got to look out for other helicopters and all that. But you can watch the race like you are on TV. Like, except instead of watching that kind of zoomed in camera on your flat screen at home, you are sitting in the helicopter actually, you know, actually watching the racing. And what's interesting about it is the gentleman that I was with, I believe you know Ben.
Yeah, Ben was, he's been on the program.
Oh, Ben has been on the program.
I have a, there's a special edition. There may be a timing issue. It may not be out when this podcast goes out, but it's coming, listeners. It's coming.
It's coming. Yeah, but anyways, Ben's a cool dude.
Benjamin
very
Hunter.
Canadian. Benjamin, and very Canadian. Not that that matters, but he was my person with me in the helicopter, and he was able to get some really incredible shots, which will be on, I don't know if he posted those with the Roadkill site or if they're on SlashGear. Maybe on SlashGear, but you should definitely link to that in your show notes. But it's of these two trophy trucks. We're out in the middle of nowhere. Like, there's nobody around except for us and these trophy trucks. And they weren't, like, in that lead group, so nobody really was kind of watching. And it was some incredible racing. This guy was trying to perform this pass. And, like, he goes up and try to do it. And he ends up trying to bump the truck out of the way. And they're smashing fenders back and forth. Like, the best sort of, like, NASCAR good old boy racing that you could imagine is going on with these trophy trucks at 100 miles an hour in the desert. And, like, other than us sitting overhead, nobody knew how intense or how awesome this racing was. And it turns out at the end of the day, one of our PR people, I don't know how they got a hold of the driver or whatever, but the subject sort of came up that they had photos of this pass, and the dude's like, I gotta have those, I gotta see it. Like, he didn't think anybody saw this awesome pass that he did, and he was like very grateful. He's like, man, that's awesome you guys saw it. He's like, can I get the pictures? Not because he wanted to dispute
it. Right.
But just because he thought it was cool that somebody saw this awesome pass that he did. So, you know, it's kind of like when you pull off, you know, one of those, you're on a back road, maybe you drift around a corner perfect, and you hit something just right, and you're like, yeah, I wish everybody saw it. You go around and nobody saw it. It's like, that's the experience of desert racing when you're a driver, because nobody's, you know, unless you're one of those main drivers, like, nobody sees this stuff. So it's cool to be able to go up into a helicopter and sort of see that experience. I know it's not available for everybody on every event, but if you ever are, you should go to a desert race. You should go to something like the Mint, especially the Mint, because you don't have to leave the country for it. You stay in Vegas, which, I mean, say what you will about Vegas, but it's, you know, it's not a bad place to spend a couple of nights. It's well organized. It's well put together. It's relatively safe. I mean, there's issues with going to a Dakar, or there's issues going to Baja, you know. Like, I don't have to worry about, you know, having to bribe Federales to go to Mint, where I have to worry about it maybe for Baja. So if you're kind of thinking, man, I'd really like to check out a desert race, like, go to the Mint. It's awesome. And what really blew me away, more than the helicopter experience and more than, you know, just kind of being there, was you can just walk the pits and you can just talk to team owners and drivers and these people that, you know, an hour later they're going to be out racing, you know, one of the most grueling races of the year, but they're willing to talk to you and show you things about their vehicle. And just the sense of community amongst the fans and the drivers is something that I haven't seen at a professional level like this before. It's very similar to, like, you know, Friday night short track racing and that kind of feel, that kind of vibe. So they're glad you're there. Like, they're not grateful you're there. Like, they're, oh, thank God you came and watched us. But, like, they're happy that you're there. They're happy for the fans. They want the fans to have a good experience. And they're willing to really go that extra kind of effort to make sure you have a good time at the race. So, and that wasn't something that was pre-planned by Toyota. I mean, Benjamin and I were just, we were just walking the paddocks and we talked to this one guy that, I guess, he helped do a story for, in Hot Rod Magazine about the Baja. But, like, just random people. Just go up and talk to them. It's pretty cool. Now, of course, we were there. Jay Leno ran. It's kind of the reason why. In the Chicago Auto Show, Jay, they Toyota announced that Jay was going to run in more or less a stock TRD Pro Tacoma to run a lap of the Mints. And then he won his class, but from my understanding, he was the only one in his class, so
I believe
came in first place, but you came in last place. but he was there, which was cool. We got to meet him the night before. He actually did a comedy set all the way up until about 12:30 in the morning, and then he had to be up at 5 to run them in. So that guy's a machine. Like, he's He's extremely grateful and gracious with his time. He knows his stuff. Whether you find his comedy funny, you know, whatever, he's okay, but he's not the funniest guy I've ever listened to. But as a genuine, motoring enthusiast, a guy that likes racing, likes cars and likes stuff, he is as genuine and as real as he is on his web series and all that stuff. So that was cool. And like I said, you know, Swears is there too. I've talked to him a little bit, just about it. The truck held up pretty well from what I understand. I think it lost a mirror and there were, you know, a few desert bruises on it, but yeah,
right.
pretty much stock Tacoma that can, you know, off the shelf, go out and run them in, which is pretty impressive. You know?
Yeah. He had a long drive suspension edition. Was it long drive?
Yeah, I think they did. You have to have some more travel.
And then that's all they had. And I think he finished first in his class.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was very cool to watch. Very cool to see all the video and the photos that came out from it. Any other fun stories in Vegas that came up while you're there?
Well, there's things I can't talk about. I mean,
how many other random strangers did you approach in Vegas?
It's Vegas. The random strangers approach you in Vegas. So we got to see the Jay Leno. We got to see Jay do a show. Like I said, it was really cool to talk to him. Our trip to Vegas, though, so we didn't start in Vegas. We actually started in Los Angeles, and we drove a TRD Pro Tundra Tacoma and then a TRD Off-Road Tacoma from Los Angeles to Vegas. So half the way was pretty much on the highway. If anybody's ever done that drive, I hadn't, so it was interesting to do it. About halfway, you stop in Baker. There's some utility off-road service roads that run about 40 miles between Baker and Los Angeles. We did all of that off-road, so that was kind of cool too. Again, I haven't had a real long time in the TRD Pro Tacoma, and I had just gotten out of a Raptor, so I kind of really wanted to. I know they're not comparison, but in the same way they are. I mean, people are buying them for similar reasons. So I was like, all right, I need to make sure I get some good time in this. And it turns out that apparently the TRD Pro Tacoma is the one in my region may have had some issues. So not mechanical, but let's just say some colleague issues.
No, that never happens in our field. No. We all can drive stick shifts and we never damage the vehicles.
There may not be a chance for me to ever get in that truck again for a regular loan where I'm at least not for a while. So I really appreciated being able to spend four or 500 miles in that truck, you know, with 100 of them being off road to really get a good feel for it. It's a lot of fun, you know, I mean, I get why the Tacoma sells, the TRD Pro is better, in my opinion, than the off-road, the TRD off-road, by not a small factor. Those Fox Racing shocks really... everything that I drive that has Fox Racing shocks a lot of these days are good. You know, the Raptor is good. TRD Pro Tacoma is good. Tires, the only thing I kind of wish it had a little bit better tires. It has some good years on it, which are fine, but, man, once you drive a truck with BFGs, those KO2s...
Yeah,
you kind of don't want to drive with anything else, but it's still a good truck. I mean, ours was like $43,000, which is $30,000 less than that Raptor I drove. It makes a compelling argument for itself. I like the truck. I'd probably buy one of the trucks. And what's cool is when you go to a desert race like that, that's all you see. You see Raptors and Tacomas. Like that's everywhere. For anything other than the trucks that are pulling, you know, the big trophy trucks and stuff like that, like everything else was Tacomas or Raptors. So
it's very true. Yeah, you go out to the desert, that's all you see too. It's what's interesting is they're all the viewpoint I've had is that the Tacomas are very modified and they tend to be in wider range mix of model years, and the Raptors are typically less modified. And well, the Raptor hasn't been out as long, so you don't have a bigger range. But a lot of these, you know, you can still take an older '80s Tacoma and put a lot of bolt-on parts on it, and have a lot of fun in the desert with it.
I mean, so some of these people were racing too. You know, they had those, you know, '80s '90s Tacomas back when they weren't even called Tacomas, and
yeah,
you know, they've got who knows how much money they have put into the truck, but they're out there running, you know, desert races. So it's people that don't understand, and I kind of got this beforehand, so it's not like a big light bulb moment for me. But if you don't really understand the Tacoma, like, you need to go to a desert race. You need to go out into the desert and you need to hang out with those people, because suddenly the Tacoma makes a boatload of sense that maybe wouldn't any other, like, it's still a good truck. Like, I'd still recommend it to people. But if you don't understand the Tacoma thing, like, if you just don't get it, go to a desert race.
Yeah.
Or go hang out in the desert on the weekends. And you will get very quickly why the Tacoma is as loved as it is.
And you will quickly understand why there are three different versions of a TRD. Why the TRD grew so quickly. So many of their sales were TRD models before, but now they have different versions of it, and why the TRD Pro is it makes sense to that community. But yeah, you really got to go there and experience it to really make sense of it.
And hallelujah, the 17s have a power slapping rear window. Woo! That was like my one big complaint about the last Tacoma I was in, was the lack of the power slide window. It's like, I want to open the window, but I can't. And yeah, you got to get out of the truck and climb in the back seat. I know it's little things like that, but it's just like, man, this has got power window. Yeah, we're good. It's great.
But those are often the little things that really separate the trucks for us. I've had an ongoing discussion with other journalists about different things, and one of them is how close the vehicles have gotten in competitiveness now. And they're all really good, and now we're just really nitpicking different things, unless we get one that's really bad. But in the truck world, they're just doing different things, different viewpoints and things, but we're getting nitpicky.
Well, so I think that it's fair to compare TRD Pro Tacoma to – hear me out. I think it's fair to compare a TRD Pro Tacoma to a Raptor to a Power Wagon, and not because of them being in the same class – or having the same work or anything like that. But generally speaking, a Raptor buyer and a Tacoma buyer, especially the TRD Pro, want something that's kind of deserty off-road. Like, they're kind of looking for a toy. They want functionality, which is why they're both trucks. But I could see somebody, maybe not necessarily cross-shopping, but somebody wondering, okay, well, what's the difference between the two? Yeah. Why would I want to go with a Raptor for X amount more money? They're not viewing it as in, oh, this is a half-ton truck. This is a, you know... this is a three-quarter ton truck. This is a mid-sized truck, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they're talking like, oh, should I get the bigger one or the smaller one? I mean, that's what they're saying. They're not saying category differences. And I totally understand that. I would say there's more crossover between the Tundra TRD Pro and the Raptor.
And the Raptor, yeah. And that makes sense because, again, they're both half-ton trucks.
Yeah.
But it was just kind of just in a discussion today that we were talking about prior to recording. Like, I love the Raptor. I would buy a Raptor. It's one of the best toy pickup trucks I've ever driven. And that's why I would want it. I'd want it because it's a toy. Like, I don't need certain functionality and stuff like that. But, you know, Power Wagon's a good truck. It's got disconnecting, the disconnecting axles for for extra ground, or, you know, extra articulation. It's a three-quarter ton truck. It can actually tow a decent amount. Like, it's better at being a truck than what Raptor is. I could see somebody saying, like, look, you know, I want a truck that can off-road. I want a truck that I can have fun out in the desert. But I also need to be able to tow, you know, it's my work truck. Maybe I need to be able to tow, you know, a digger, or, you know, a couple of lawnmowers, or, you know, things like that. You may be using it as, like, a work truck. And Raptor as a work truck, it kind of works, but it's not.
No, the Raptor is built so far beyond the truck to the desert runner. You know, and the Power Wagon is still a truck, as well as being an off road. And it really, the Power Wagon is so hard to categorize. So, I've driven them all, and I've driven them all different events and different places, loans and things. And what I really appreciate about each of them is it's just a different thing. Like, so the Power Wagon, I always joke around with the Power Wagon, like, it's the ultimate truck. Like, I love the winch. Like, I've literally used the winch on different occasions, and I love that feature of the Power Wagon. And I love the fact that good luck getting the damn thing stuck, right? I mean, it's so big and massive that – massive being strong and capable, not size-wise, but it just –
it is a big truck.
It is a big truck, but it's good luck getting it stuck. And then the Raptor, it's like – the thing with the Raptor and the thing that I learned and the first time I drove it was that 3.5 liter EcoBoost they put in a higher output EcoBoost, replaced the V8. It's so quick. It's so quick. And I can't explain it enough to people that so I'm driving a Tacoma off-road right now this week, and I was out in Wyoming, dirt roads, driving around with it, and I had a hard time getting it sideways because it does not have enough low-end torque to really get off line speed. It's got, and I'm driving the V6, and I still feel like I don't have the wow factor, whereas I knew if I was driving a Raptor, the Raptor would be there where I'm hoping the Tacoma will go. I guess is a good way to say that. And so it's interesting to see those differences.
I know it's the same thing with the TIV Pro Tacoma. You know, I would hit the traction control button once because that does the auto LSD and it turns off some of the traction control. And there were parts in this desert course like I kind of want to slide, and either I put my foot down and the transmission's a little slower to pick a gear. Or it can't find the gear. Like, it's crazy that there's not enough gears, but six gears isn't really enough once you've driven kind of that 10.
Yeah.
Like, Raptor just seemed to always... Raptor always seemed to be able to do what I wanted it to do when I wanted it to do it.
And with the Raptor, you're much more able to get in trouble faster. The Tacoma, you can back off a little while it's revving up, but the Raptor, it's got that pucker factor. Like, oh, okay, here we go. And, you know, it you can get in trouble quickly with it.
The one thing, though, with Raptor, and I was talking about this sort of in my general review, one of the ones that I wrote up, was I feel extremely confident driving a Jeep Wrangler. And I know this will be a weird kind of comparison, but the Jeep Wrangler, you don't think, at least for me, I don't think about the Jeep when I'm driving. When I'm going through an off-road trail, when I'm in a Wrangler, like, I'm paying attention to the scenery, I'm looking at things, I'm, you know, keeping an eye on the trail, but I'm not worrying about the vehicle. Because it's a Wrangler. It's not going to get stuck. Like,
yeah, yeah.
It's, you know, it's, you have to work to get a Wrangler stuck in a lot of situations. Just because it gives you so much confidence as a driver, because you don't have to worry about the vehicle. Raptor's the same way. With the new one, especially. You know, between the Fox Racing suspension, which does a really good job at keeping all four wheels, you know, planted, regardless of what the truck's doing. The KO2s that will grip anywhere.
They're amazing tires.
You know, and then the Ford Performance Magic that they kind of put in with the electronics and all of that. Like, you have that same sort of... confidence with Raptor. Like, I never felt like I was going to get stuck. I never felt like I needed to worry about the truck. Like, it was almost too, and we were at a fairly difficult off-road park. I'm not going to say it's, you know, really challenging or anything, but it's where I take a lot of our vehicles, and it was almost too easy. Like, I almost kind of wish the truck wasn't as good, because maybe I'd have a little bit more fun. Maybe it'd be a little bit more challenging at a lower level. Raptor's limits are so high and the capabilities are so high of that truck that most people aren't going to find them. Most people aren't going to get close to that.
Yeah, and that's where your Tacoma comes in really well, because it's you save a lot of the money, you still get a lot of performance, even though it isn't as fast. And I think that's, like, I've called the Tacoma, or I've actually called the Tundra TRD Pro, the poor man's version of the Raptor, because it does what most people can do off-road. The Raptor can just take you to a different level. But with that note, we can talk for hours, but we're like three times over my limit.
I just want to say, compared to the old Raptor, TRD Pro Tundra is good. Compared to the new Raptor, though, like, there's nothing. Like, I haven't, there's just nothing.
Yeah,
I don't know
yeah.
if it's worth 30 grand more than, like, a TRD Pro Tacoma. Once you factor in options and stuff, I think a base Raptor is like 56. That's a pretty good deal at that price. But just go to a desert race, have fun. You'll be cleaning sand out of your lungs for like 2 days afterwards. But it's okay. It's worth it. It's fun. It's cool. So
and where can people find more about the Chad Kirshner?
The Chad Kirshner. All of my work is at chadkirshner.com, but I do run a website and a podcast called Future Motoring, which is futuremotoring.com.
All right. I'll have that in the show notes. Thanks, Chad.
Great. Thanks, Tim. I really appreciate it.
off-road I've been driving this week. It is the double cab with a long bed. What's interesting about this is it's got that sandy quicksand color to it. I actually took it snow goose hunting and I parked it up on a hill. I have a photo on it on our Pickup Truck Talk Facebook page. And I swear that that color is like the best camouflage color for this time of year out here. You know, it's wintertime, everything's kind of brown and dead, and that color just blends right in. I parked it off in the distance while we were hunting, and you only could see the rear bumper and the taillights. I mean, it blended in so well. So I've been mixed on that color. I know it's a big fan among off-road enthusiasts. I actually was driving around with somebody who had worked for the U.S. Army, and they just didn't know about it because it'd been on so many Army vehicles. So they thought they were going back to work. This is so I'm driving the off-road version, and so we should understand that the off-road version is different than the Tacoma TRD or Tacoma Pro version. So it's I should say my vernacular correctly. I'm driving the TRD off-road version, and I had the TRD Pro version a couple weeks ago. And the big key difference here with the off-road version and the Pro version is the Pro more money, and it's got all the features. Really, the comparison here is between the off-road version and the Sport version. Those are the two that more equally line up in the Toyota Tacoma lineup. Interestingly enough, I was doing research on this for my review, and I came across a story I wrote that explained the differences on the two systems, the two trim levels, because it's hard to tell the off-road versus the Sport. The Sport, from exterior-wise, has a color-matched hood scoop, and it's got a gray grille. It's got color-matched mirrors, door handles, over fenders, and rear bumper. So it's got a bunch of the styling changes. So if you don't need the styling changes and you want more of the rugged off-road version, the off-road is more what you want to do. It has 16-inch Wrangler Kevlar reinforced tires, off-road tuned Bilstein shocks. The Sport has Sport tuned, and that the off-road package comes standard with a chrome rear bumper and black front bumper, and those help distinguish it as well. Also, what's important of the differences here is that the Sport version has the Sport tuned suspension, 17-inch wheels, and it comes standard in part-time four-wheel drive. The off-road version comes with multi-terrain select, crawl control, and off-road suspension. Okay, so those are the key differences between the two models. They both have the same 3.5-liter V6, and they both offer a manual and automatic transmission. The Sport version can get better fuel economy since it does have a two-wheel drive version because it has a part-time four-wheel drive. The off-road version comes in four-wheel drive. So there you go. There's your main differences between the off-road and the Sport. I've been driving the off-road. I've used multi-terrain select. When I've thought about it, I usually just drive. I don't really think about that kind of stuff very much. A few instances where I could have used it. I've used crawl control before in different places. Crawl control is a fantastic feature. I'd have to really get out some nasty weather to be able to use it in my area make it feasible to use. I'd have to go really in some big snowstorms or really go through some muddy pits to be able to use that feature. Overall, I mean, this vehicle has more off-roading than capable than I would push it to. I think that's one of the things that you're getting to with these Tacomas is they're so well equipped for off-roading that it's hard pressed to be able to use all those features in a standard day-to-day lifestyle. Here in Western Nebraska, you know, we get some bad snowstorms. We get some off-roading situations with going hunting back to the farmers' fields and trails and things that most trucks can make it through in four-wheel drive. You really don't need all the features of crawl control or multi-terrain select. And like I said, frankly, I've been doing driving up to our goose blind. I've been driving up to through dirt roads and things, and I haven't even considered putting multi-terrain select on it. So, you know, again, you have to come down to lifestyle whether you think that's a good feature for you or not. It does have the 3.5-liter V6. It's got the Atkinson cycle to improve fuel economy, which I suppose it does. Mine's rated at 18 and 23 with 20 combined. I think I'm getting about a little bit around 19. I have been driving it hard. I've been trying to get an understanding of the differences between the Tacoma and the Raptor and really understand the engine performance differences, as we talked about with Chad earlier in the program. And like I said with him on that show, that segment, it's just not as fast. Even though I'm trying to get it as fast, put my foot down in it, It's just it's not as quick off the line, but it's capable once you get the speed. I mean, there's no concerns there with power loss. One of the things I do like about it is it has the tonneau cover on it, which is just a little line item on my Monroney or my sticker that shows all the information on it. But it's got a four. It's a locking, folding, three, trifold locking tonneau cover. And so the segments, there's a latch underneath the driver's side on the rear of the, underneath the tonneau cover. And you pull this latch and the first segment pops up, second segment pops up, third. Third stays where it's at. It has actually got a bolt. It's bolted on to the side of the bed, or bolted on the side of the rail. You can remove it if you absolutely had to, but it takes some more work. What I like about this feature is I was able to take my trash out. Yeah, I have a picture of my on the Facebook page where my trash can fits perfectly when I do the first fold of the tonneau cover up and out of the way. And so from a consumer standpoint, it's a very handy feature. You have the hard tonneau cover, so it keeps out some of the rain. It does get some dust in there. I did learn that. But it keeps out the rain, keeps out like snow and stuff from getting damaging the stuff inside that tonneau cover. But it's also really easy to use. It's a one-hand operation. You open it up and then you flip it over and then you can put stand stuff up in there. So really handy, really something I've never seen Toyota put out there. It hasn't been on very many press vehicles, hasn't been in very many places that I've seen it. But something to check out with your dealer. It's a little pricey, $6,500. But as far as usability and as far as convenience factors, it's definitely up there for me with like heated seats and things. I mean, that's definitely a nice feature to have. So we had a bunch of the TRD accessories, spare tire lock, emergency assistance kit, paint protection film, things like that, TRD air filter. And I'm going to take a bunch of photos of that and do maybe a collage of all the accessories out there. My test model came in at priced at $42,644 with $940 dealer processing handling fee, which is a considerable amount. It starts at $35,315, but you add all the premium technology like the JBL audio and the tonneau cover and a tow package and things, and you can add it pretty fast. So something to think about. The long bed is nice. I guess just to say that I've used it to haul some things. It's nicer than the smaller bed, but I don't know that it made that much difference for me. So check it out, local dealership. So they have them on sale right now. And thanks for listening to the Pickup Truck Plus SUV podcast. I've had a cold this week, so if you've heard me mumble around and make some funny things, that's just me being sick and my mind's not very clear. But make sure you check us out. Check us out on pickuptrucktalk.com. See my cold coming up. Pickup Truck Talk on Facebook, and check us on iTunes and Google Play. And we'll see you down the road.